This conference will now be recorded.
Right, hello everybody, and welcome to this special teleclass with a very special guest. I'm joined today by Mr. Mike Samuels, and today we're going to be talking about copywriting. So, hello, Mike.
Hey Dom, how you doing?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad at all. Can't complain whatsoever.
Excellent, excellent. So, Mike, this is the first time I've ever done a copywriting masterclass sort of lesson with my guys. So, and you kind of come from a different industry, obviously, don't you? To we deal with pets, and you're primarily fitness. Would I be right in saying that?
Certainly came from a fitness background. It's
Right.
branched out a bit more now, but yeah, fitness was originally my bread and butter.
Right. Cool. Yeah. But obviously, a lot of the principles are going to be applicable across any industry, aren't they? Really.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Cool. All right then. So before we kick off, Mike, why don't we? I like to find out a bit about. I like my guys to know a bit about the people who we're talking to. So let's go right back in time. Talk about where you're from, what life was like with growing up and stuff, and how you kind of fell into the fitness industry, I guess.
Cool. So yeah, I think actually the term fell in is pretty true, to be honest. So I suppose sort of growing up, I'd always just thought of the typical, you do well at school, you go to college, you go to university, you get a job where you start at 8:30, finish at 5, wear a suit, and that was just kind of what was gonna happen, really. And I suppose I followed that path for up until I was about 17, 18, and I went to college to do A levels and thought, I'm going to do law and business just because they seem sensible choices. And actually, obviously growing up, I had all the visions of being a footballer and an astronaut and that kind of stuff. And then thought, let's get something a bit more sensible. I quite fancy being a solicitor. Like I knew some people who did it and they seemed to do pretty well. They seemed to kind of tolerate their job, perhaps not enjoy it, but tolerate it. So yeah, that was my plan up until I was about 16, and then started studying law at college and hated it. I found it unbelievably tedious, and you could have offered me all the money in the world to do it, and I'd have said no thanks. That's really not my bag anymore. So I was kind of at a bit of a crossroads, and I, along with business and law, I chose to study PE just because I'd kind of always been sporty, and I thought, well, that can be a fallback, and I can do something in sport if I want to. And then the more I thought about it, the more viable an option it was to go into something in the fitness industry. And I'd been doing my own training. I was quite a keen runner at the time and had got into lifting weights sort of sporadically. And so, yeah, that was the career I chose to go down. So, when would that have been? Sort of end of 2008, I moved from Southampton. I moved to London to study full time to be a personal trainer. And so, yeah, end part of 2008, 3 months, I was living away from home for the first time. And yeah, by the very start of 2009, I had qualified and got a job in a Fitness First in London. So that was kind of the start of everything to lead me into working for myself.
Start of the journey. Wow. So you went from footballer to astronaut to lawyer to falling back on your PE and becoming a fitness trainer.
Yeah,
It's funny how life works out, isn't
I don't know how realistic or viable the footballer and astronaut routes were. So I don't think we can necessarily class those as wise career choices. And I didn't do too much to get too far along the line needed to get there. But yeah, it was law was the first thing I thought of. Oh, yeah, I'm going to really enjoy that and I'll earn good money. And then yeah, got into it and just no way. I'm sure it works for some people, but I just could not see myself doing that every single day for 40 plus years.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Me, actually, a couple of things. One is that was why I ended up leaving my job with Imperial Tobacco, who I worked for them for 10 years, and I just couldn't stand the thought of doing it for another 30. And I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do then, although I ended up falling into the dog business from there. But what I was going to say was, isn't it interesting how, like, here I am, a dog walker slash trainer, and you doing fitness copywriting and stuff now, and I guess what I was thinking was, as you were talking, traditionally, when you're at school, you think of like PE as being something that like the divvies do, you know, like the people. Yeah, well, no, you do though, don't you? But then it's, oh, you know, and I don't know, nobody walks a dog, but like, but then these, they can, you know, when, because you're taught, or we'll have it drummed into us, as you obviously did, you know, the whole path of university and all of it and everything. But you can make a fucking special business, can't you, out of something like PE or dog walking or something.
Yeah, and I think I look at the people who I went to school with, and actually the ones who seem to be doing the best now, and obviously best is subjective, but, yeah, you know, best in terms of lifestyle and earnings and that kind of thing. They're not the, they don't tend to be the ones who are brightest at school, and they don't tend to be the ones who actually did go that academic route. They're more the people who found something they wanted to do. And I'm not one of those people who says, like, find your passion and follow it, because I think that's perhaps quite an immature way to build a business if you purely base it around what you enjoy. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, we'd all be out there being professional Ben and Jerry's testers and Netflix watchers. But yeah, certainly the people who chose the more non-traditional routes, I think on the whole, if you enjoy something and you do it because you want to, not because it's the dumb thing, there's probably a greater chance of success in that long term.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Yeah. And I've noticed a similar thing with my old school friends as well. And incidentally, yeah, I saw yesterday Cadbury's were advertising for chocolate tasters, Mike, so you're completely wrong there. Although I think you'd only pay £10 an hour.
To be fair though, how much chocolate could you eat in an hour? Because I mean, that could probably actually correlate to more like 50 quid an hour if, well, you could eat a fair amount.
Yeah, I just thought it was tasting. I didn't think it was like a competition where you had to shove as much down your neck. But maybe it's, I didn't read the advert properly. So what happened from there then? Talk us through what happened next. Did you say it was fitness first you were with?
Yeah, so I went to
a gym or?
Yeah, so fitness first. I mean, I think they've now merged with another company because they were one of those mid-price gyms that seems to have gone by the wayside now. I think people obviously, these days, they either go for the budget 24-hour places or they go for the high-end places with the pool and spa and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, Fitness First now, I believe, have merged with another chain. But at the time, they were, I think they were the lead or had the most number of health clubs in the UK. It was the time before, like, Pure Gym and all that kind of thing. Yeah, so I moved from East London down to live in Wimbledon, just so I quite fancied moving to Southwest London, got a job in Fitness First and didn't really do very well. If I'm 100% honest, it was very much a case of I spent 18 months there and just about made enough to cover my bills and basic living expenses. And even a couple of times had to dip back into the bank of mum and take out a couple of short-term loans from her to get me through. And I did it and got to 18 months and thought, this is just not a sustainable way to go. And I didn't particularly enjoy it. I didn't like being in a gym. I didn't enjoy having to give a large chunk of my income to the gym. Basically, how they worked was you kept all the money you made, but you had to give them, I think it's like 150 quid a week or something to work there. So got to that stage and thought, I'm going to give it one more go, but I'm going to try it in a slightly less risky atmosphere, I guess. And so left the gym, moved back home to Southampton and decided that I would try the freelance route. So that would have been the kind of middle of 2010, I think I moved back. And again, it was really slow going at first. I had no clue how to market myself. Social media wasn't what it is now. I didn't know about email lists, so all I did was put a couple of adverts in local papers, and just gradually it started to pick up. And actually by summer 2012, so what, 2 years pretty much, 2 years from the time I moved back, I think at that point I was doing 48 sessions a week. So I was doing 7 days a week. I was training people in their homes, so I was driving round as well. So those 48 sessions, I had traveling time on top of that. And yeah, basically got to the point where I thought, earning really well here, doing a job I always thought I wanted to do, but the workload and the hours made me start to hate it. So that was again a time when I thought, I suppose I got to the stage where I thought, if you'd have told me 2 years ago you can be doing nearly 50 sessions a week, do you want to be doing that, I'd have bitten your hand off. And taken that in an instant, because I'd have thought that would be absolutely amazing. But the reality was actually that I was really burnt out, tired. You know, like I said, I think through 2012, I worked out. I took there were basically 21 days the whole year where I didn't do any work. So including weekends, Christmas, Easter, birthday, going away. Yeah, and just basically couldn't see it doing that long term, really.
Yeah, cool. So had you how would you kind of position yourself then, Mike? Were you particularly expensive, or were you kind of middle of the road, would you say, pricing wise, or what?
I would say I was pretty middle of the road. Yeah. Again, yeah. I figured that my business knowledge, and I say that with air quotes around it, but my business knowledge told me, don't be more expensive than anyone else, because then no one's going to hire you. Now, and I don't know, you might want to get into this later, but you know, now that wouldn't be my advice to anyone at all. But yeah, at the time it was, you know, for a 21, 22 year old, it was pretty good to be earning 25 quid an hour, basically just standing there telling people, lift this up, put it back down again, do 10 of those, looking at a stopwatch. But yeah, my positioning was non-existent, really. And I think it was more a case that basically the one thing that really helped was I learned some basic SEO, which doesn't really work. Well, certainly not doing it organically doesn't work at all these days. Mm-hmm. But back at the time, it was quite easy to rank a website up at right at the top of Google for any searches to do with personal training in Southampton. And so at the time I was busiest, I was getting probably 5 or 6 inquiries a week, I guess.
Right.
I think just for the fact that by that point I'd had quite a bit of experience just working with people, really. And so actually I seemed to keep clients as well. I didn't have many who just came for a month or two. Actually, fast forward to when I finished in 2016, I kind of wrapped it all up. Everyone who I finished with at that point had been training with me for at least 3.5 years. So yeah, I seemed to keep clients, which is massively helpful.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, so I think, like, yeah, positioning wise and pricing wise, I didn't do anything particularly well. I certainly would change how I did that now, but purely from kind of being visible, being consistent, and to a degree, again, I'd probably change this now, but certainly working to almost any schedule a client would want. So if someone wanted to train at 5:30 in the morning, I'd go, yep, happy days, let's do it. If they wanted a Sunday, the only time I didn't work, I gave myself, I wouldn't work past 4:00 on a Saturday or past 2:00 on a Sunday. But aside from that, I made myself really, really flexible. So I think that while I didn't do it perfectly at all, it was probably those bits that meant actually the business really picked up.
Yeah, for sure. So I assume, well, what happened next then?
So 2012, that was when I was really busy and carried on. I think I was like that for the best part of a year. And then 2013, I realized that I didn't really want to be doing that much more at all. The quicker I could stop doing so many hours of always being with people, and it's not because I didn't like the work, and it's not because I didn't want to do the work at all, but there was no freedom with it. So it was, you know, sort of 9-10 hours a day, awkward hours as well. So it was rare that you ever got an evening off. It was rare that you could ever have a lie-in. Every Saturday morning was work. So I kind of fancied the idea of being a writer, but I didn't really know how to go about it. And I'd also read a few bits saying that online coaching is going to be the next big thing in fitness. And so I did a couple of bits. I put an offer out to basically to my Facebook page, I think, saying, does anyone want any free online coaching? I'm going to do it free for 12 weeks. It's basically to see if I like it. And if you want to carry on at the end, fantastic. We can talk fees then. But I'm doing it free for 12 weeks and expected to have a handful of people. And I ended up with about 30 something, I think. Mm-hmm. And so that was when I realized that was a viable thing to do. And it really wasn't too time consuming. I was probably earning, if you worked out per hour, probably double what I was from the one-on-one PT stuff at the time. Plus, I could do it from home, from a coffee shop. You could do it when you're away still. Mm-hmm. So that made me see that was possible. And then I also started getting into the writing. So I set up my own blog, which I kept separate from all my personal training stuff. And I also got a job working for Livestrong. So at the time they had, they were basically trying to get their search rankings up purely by creating so much content and creating articles based around any sort of keyword, key phrase, anything like that. And so, yeah, I managed to get a gig with them where it was on a freelance basis and you did as much or as little as you wanted, but they paid about $30 an article, and an article would take about half an hour to do. And there was loads and loads of work there. So I actually ended up gradually reducing the amount of one-on-one training stuff I was doing. Mm-hmm. And probably, where would this have gone to? Probably by mid-2014, I would say. I'd probably got down to about 25 hours of personal training a week. And then 25 to 30 hours was the writing stuff, the online stuff. And from there, it just gradually turned into doing a bit less one-on-one. So if someone dropped off, I didn't try and replace them. Or if there was a client who, it sounds horrid, but I didn't really like working with, I basically gently let them go and just start to pick up more online stuff, really. More online stuff, more writing. So yeah, I suppose that was the next phase, really.
Brilliant. So had you always written then? Or, do you know what I mean? Have you always been a writer? Or what was it, just something that you just started doing then?
I didn't really like it at school, but when I'd been working in London, because I didn't have many clients at all, I spent a lot of time reading fitness websites and listening to podcasts. And so they're always interviewing guys like Nate Green was a big inspiration of mine. He was sort of one of the big fitness writers at the time. People like John Romanello, Lou Schuler, who was the only person I knew who actually got paid full time to write fitness stuff. And so I consumed a lot of content from those type of people. And actually by then following them on social media, seeing the kind of lives they led, I thought, actually, this is now much more what I want. And at the time I was thinking, it's different from what I do now, but I was thinking, I'd love to write fitness articles full time, or I'd love to be a writer for men's health, men's fitness, for T Nation, something like that. And I guess that was the catalyst to it, really, was that I dabbled a bit with doing some blogs for my personal training site. When I started doing more online stuff, I started to see the value of writing and being able to communicate well. And so gradually started picking up that. But yeah, it was more, I guess I got into it because I wanted to have the lifestyle rather than just wanting to write for the sake of writing.
No, I like it. I like it. A couple of quick lessons I'm going to pick up on there for my guys that before we continue with the journey. One is when you started to do online PTing, online training, you said you charged more. Yeah, did you say you got paid more than what you did in person?
It worked out about double the hourly
rate. Double, yeah. And this is something that changing the way that you sell something, like a lot of people think that, you know, well, if I might charge, say, £80 an hour for dog training, but if I'm going to do a Skype call with someone, I'll charge £25. Well, that's not how you should be thinking about doing it, really. It's still like your time and you can change the price, but you can change it the way that you changed it then. You know, I just think a lot of my guys are going to be going in, dog trainers are going to be expanding more into like online dog training and stuff. And it has its challenges, the same as probably what online, you know, the PTing does as well. But, your time is no less valuable, or can be more valuable, because you're changing the way that you're selling it. And the other thing I was going to say was, interesting point, when you talked about, when you looked at these writers that you kind of wanted, you saw the kind of lifestyle that they had, you know, and the fitness writers, and you modeled them a little bit, didn't you, I suppose? You thought, well, these guys are good at writing, I'm going to have to get good at writing, even though you didn't. Like you say, you weren't hugely passionate about it at the time, but you thought, this is something I'm going to have to fucking get down and dirty with, aren't you, if I want to be like those guys.
Yeah, 100%.
And, 100%. And I talk about this a lot with my guys. I talked about the last boot camp as well, about, in fact, for the dog trainers boot camp, I identified kind of 7 traits of highly successful dog trainers. Yeah, you know, like hugely famous, often millionaire dog trainers and stuff. And we looked at the type of things that they're doing in their lives and their business, you know, and said, if you want to be like them, this is something that I learned like from reading Dan Kennedy stuff and that, you know, if you want to be like that, you need to start doing the kind of things that they're doing to get to where they want to be. You know, you can't just wish and want your way there. You have to actually take on some of the traits, don't you?
Yeah, I guess it's the idea that success leaves clues, and actually,
yes,
no one gets in my scenario. You know, you want to be on the big websites, but you realize no one gets to doing that the first time round. You have to put in the legwork to begin with and get some rejections and just do something for the sake of doing it to get better at it. So yeah, while there's, I guess over time I learned to actually enjoy the craft of writing, but to begin with it was more, this is a means to an end. There's a purpose for doing this, and it's not necessarily to actually be doing this, it's to like take it to the next level or several levels up, I suppose.
Cool. So when did you kind of discover that you had this sort of superpower then for writing? And I suppose when did it kind of merge into copywriting then? Is that what comes next possibly?
Yeah, I would say so, because this was, yeah, I suppose up to sort of 2014. It was actually, so with this, I'd started doing some a bit more online stuff and was doing pretty well with it. I'd had an ebook out as well, and the ebook massively surprised me with how well it did. But basically, sort of, I released that in the summer, I think, and it hit a peak and then just gradually started to tail off. But I don't know how. Well, actually, I do know how. But I was getting about 60,000 website hits a month, because I'd had a couple of articles that had, I suppose you'd say they went viral. I think one had 135,000 views in the first 24 hours, just where it was shared so much.
Jesus.
But I had a couple of these where, without really meaning to write stuff that did that, I'd had a couple of articles that were getting a lot of traffic to them. And so I was having about 60,000 hits on the site a month. And was doing fine, was doing well, but wanted to know how to monetize it further. And so I posted in a fitness marketing group just saying, does anyone know anyone who might be able to help me with this? And quite a few people tagged in a guy called Dan Meredith.
Yeah.
And Dan, who is definitely a character, I remember it was on a Friday afternoon, actually, and he sent me a message straight away, said, I've promised my girlfriend I'm going to take the weekend off from work, but if you send me your number, I'll give you a ring on Monday. And then Saturday morning, about 9 o'clock, I was sitting in a coffee shop and he phoned me up, or rather a number appeared on my screen. I thought, no idea who that is. Answer anyway, it was Dan. And for about an hour and a half, he just had a chat to me, and there was no pitch or anything there. He basically just kind of went through some simple stuff I could do, found out a bit about what I was doing, and then did a low-key pitch to just say, look, if you want to carry on working together, here are my rates, no pressure, but let me know. I'd already made up my mind I wanted to work with him, and so initially for a couple of months I paid him as a mentor and he helped me out with all the online stuff. And then gradually when we were working together, he seemed to feel I had a talent for writing. I didn't particularly feel I did, but he said, you know, the way you write, actually, I think you'd be pretty good at writing copy. Do you want to stop paying me money? I'll still mentor you, but you can write for some of my clients. He had a digital marketing agency at the time and it was growing. So we had an arrangement where instead of me paying him for mentoring, I would do some of the more basic work for his clients. He wouldn't tell the client, he'd just kind of look through it and pass it off as his. But yeah, we did that for a couple of months. And then he actually said, do you want to come on board and be part of the agency? And actually, we scrapped the mentoring stuff and you come and do this for me. Not quite full time, because I was still doing the online fitness stuff. But he basically guaranteed me about as much money as I was earning from the online fitness stuff, but for probably similar to when I switched online initially, for about half the work. And so, yeah, that was kind of the journey, really. It was end of 2014. And I worked with Dan until probably summer of 2015, I guess. So it's probably about 8-9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I guess I don't want to say the rest is history because that's a that's a ridiculous phrase to say. But yeah, since then it's just kind of kept on growing, I guess.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. And just to fill peeps in, this is kind of where I my first contact with you was, because I did Dan's Elite Six program thing that he sold within the Coffee with Dan group, you know, which I believe you did a couple of webinars in. I think maybe it's on copywriting and storytelling, maybe something like that. Maybe it's copywriting.
Yeah, I'm sure he always seems to rope me in for doing something with his program.
Yeah, and then obviously we've kind of kept in touch and stuff. I came along to see you at Sucks event.
Yes.
Last year? Yeah, last year. And just about to become a client of Stephen's, actually, full-time. So he was just mentioning you the deal because I think he's going to send you some stuff for some of my adverts that will be going out.
Yeah, I do a bit of Stephen now,
Yeah. So what does your kind of business look like now then?
So my main, I suppose you can call it a job, I suppose my main gig is... I work with a company called Clients on Demand, who they specialize in doing high ticket webinar funnels, essentially. And so probably about half my working week, probably about sort of 15 hours a week, is working with them and helping their clients. So critiquing stuff like Facebook ads, critiquing webinars, helping them write copy for various bits and pieces, for emails, for engaging their Facebook groups, all that kind of stuff. And then the other 15 hours, I try and limit myself to about 30 hours a week now. So the other 15 hours is, it's kind of a mishmash, which makes me sound really, really unprofessional. But there's always a relatively steady stream of stuff coming in. So, yeah, I do some fitness stuff still, just because I suppose I built my network on social media initially when I was in fitness. And so I get a fair bit of that coming through. Do quite a bit in the health and supplement space too. So, that's probably the majority of it, actually. There's probably more of that than there is fitness stuff, which is cool. That's quite good fun. And then I get, a random mishmash of other bits and pieces come through. Some stuff for like business-based offers. I'm trying to think what else I have. Different coaching bits and pieces. There's even been some stuff in the relationship space before, even bits in the finance world. So they're fewer and farther between. But yeah, that's a typical week, I guess.
Right, cool stuff. And enjoying it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, for me, the big thing is that without sounding cheesy, it does make a difference to people. Like if someone's got terrible copy and they pay you to rewrite it and all of a sudden they've got a great business. Yeah, you feel pretty good about that. And for me, it's the lifestyle side of things. The fact that 95% of my work can be done from anywhere, as long as I've got my laptop and a Wi-Fi connection, doesn't matter where I am, what time I do it. And that's always been the big thing for me, is that I do want to keep growing, and no one ever, pretty much everyone does want to keep earning a bit more, but I've always said that for me, lifestyle is the big thing. And if I can pay my bills, have a good quality of life, and not have to stress over what I do for work, that's the big thing. So yeah, it's allowed me to live the kind of life that I want to.
Cool, mate. Brilliant. And yeah, no, I've heard you talk more about kind of, you know, the lifestyle and stepping back from certain things. And yeah, for sure, you're something that I'm doing more of as well. So you mentioned it there, and it's a subject of the teleclass. So what is copywriting essentially, and why is it important?
So the way I think of it is that I suppose, to bust the myth first off, a lot of people think that copywriting is either simply selling with words, or they think it's hard selling with words. And then, yes, you obviously do get the people who are very, very pitch focused, and you get their, you know, all their emails, and they bombard your inbox or your social media, and everything has some sort of pitch in it. But for me, I'd rather describe it as using the written word to get someone to take a desired action. So the desired action could be, simply getting them to build a bond with you, you know, sending out something that makes them think, actually, you know, Dom really knows what he's talking about, or thinking, actually, you know, Mike's got something different to offer than everyone else out there who's doing that as well. It could be opting in for something. It could be watching a video, you know, it could be making the sale as well. So it's really a case of getting people to take a desired action through the written word. And in terms of why it's important, it's, I've made the mistake in the past of telling people it's the most important skill to have as a business owner. And now I don't think that's true. I think it's very, very important, but you need to have a good offer, because if you've got an offer that no one wants, the best copy in the world is not going to sell it. And even if it does, you're going to have lots of unhappy people who bought it and then realize it's not a great product or service or whatever. But in terms of why it's important, more and more people are starting businesses now, and every single industry seems to be getting more cramped. And unless you're someone like an Elon Musk who comes up with new ideas and new concepts all the time, you need to find a way to make yourself stand out. And so actually, there's a couple of ways you can do that. But copywriting is a big one. So whether you're using copy to show that you're different from the competition, whether you're using it to show that you're better, you get superior results, or you're just using it to display your personality, it's the way I talk to people about it as well, it's something that's never gonna go out of fashion. You know, you can learn all the fancy hacks for Facebook and for Instagram and for paid ads, but at the end of the day, in 5 years' time, all that stuff could change. Like the SEO that I learned all those years ago, that was great at the time. Yeah, exactly. Whereas actually, if you learn copy, you're learning the art and the science of persuasion and relationship building. And no matter how the mediums change, you're always going to be able to use that.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Brilliant. A couple of things you said there, Mike, will really resonate with my guys, because I talk about this all the time about we're standing out from the competition. This is something that everyone comes to me with. You know, when I ask them what their biggest challenge is, they say there's too much competition and they need to stand out from the competition. But then when we look, we find that there's the reason why they're not standing out from the competition is that very often they're not doing anything different at all, you know. So even if they are offering a different and better service, they're not communicating that, you know what I mean? And yeah, so standing out different and better is the name of the game, isn't it? You know, you've got that's how you're going to stand out. That's how you're going to end up getting the clients that you want, isn't it? And getting enough clients.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's two aspects to that. And I'd always recommend people try and use both. But a lot of people, they think they're not different. Most people definitely are. But there's a couple of ways to stand out. One is by showing how your product or service is different. And you'll do that by, if I say pointing out the flaws in other methods, it's not a case you have to go around and in a piece of copy, you have to write down, like, here are the other five local competitors and here's why they're a load of crap. Yeah. But if you can just subtly point out, you know, here's why another method might not work so well. Or if you've tried this in the past and it's not worked, then here's the reason why. And here's how the way we do things tackles that. So showing that your product or service is different. And the second way is personality. A lot of people, they can have a product that is quite similar to a lot of other people in the same space, but because they get their personality across, and more so than personality is probably values. Values are a big one. So if in your copy and in your marketing, you're putting out there about what's important to you. You mentioned earlier me talking about lifestyle. I talk about that a lot because that is important to me. I don't want people to follow me to be the kind of people who want to go and build like a massive business empire, or who want to do high pressure sales calls and get 10 grand off people all the time. That's not the type of people I want to work with. So for me, having your personality and values come through, in so much as, you know, I value freedom, value lifestyle, that kind of thing, that's the other way you can stand out. And like I said, ideally you do both. You do, how is a product or service different, and how is my personality different?
Yeah. And these are traditionally two things that, or three things that people have great resistance to doing, don't they, at first, you know, because they want to stand out, but they're frightened to stand out and they don't want to rock the boat, you know. Certainly that's what I find anyway.
Well, I think it's difficult to do it, more so from a mindset standpoint sometimes, because you a lot of the time you'll see other people doing it, and again, it's probably more like this now than it was several years ago. But everyone sees, particularly in an industry like fitness, but they'll see the people on social media, and I suppose for dog training as well, you'll see the celebrities who do it, and they might not always do that. But that's because they've already got such a big audience there, they maybe don't need to as much. So they've kind of they do it subtly, but not in an overly obvious way. But if you're not like that and you don't have a following in the 6 or 7 figure range, then doing those couple of bits is important. But it does take a bit of drilling down into your business and maybe just picking up the things that to you seem quite small in terms of how you do things differently. But actually, if you can bring that to the forefront of your marketing and you can say, well, other trainers focus on X, Y, and Z, but we use this 4-step system. To you, that 4-step system might be really boring because you use it every day. To someone who's reading that for the first time, if they've gone and tried all this other stuff and it's not worked, this 4-step system seems like a new solution. And that's going to make them suddenly feel super confident that actually what you do might be the thing to finally get the results they want.
Yeah, no, dead right. Just to back that up as well, I've just been doing some seminars at the weekend, and one of the seminars I'm touring with is the Worry Free Walks workshop that is based upon the new dog training book. And within the seminar, I'm showing people how to enjoy a worry free walk, how to get from the front door to the park and back again without any sort of stress and shouting. And so that's what I do. I break it down and show them the steps, and I don't think I'm teaching anything particularly special. You know what I mean? A lot of it's just like common sense. But yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of key things almost always that people will take away from it that'll be like lightning bolts for them. But to me, it's just like it's old hat because we've been doing it for so long. How do we go about how would you go about like identifying what those key things could be then to differentiate you?
So
And
I
then
think
bringing them out when you're marketing, when
you
you're
need to
copying.
look at what it is you actually do and what makes you different. Like I said, that's not always the easiest thing, but if you can kind of take a step back and look at the basic overview of how you work with someone. So let's say the average client comes to you and I don't know, let's just say you might do 8 sessions with them, the average person to get the result. Look at what you do in each session, because even if you do this subconsciously, you're going to have some sort of plan. Week one, it might be a case of like stripping it right back to basics. Week two, you might do some more sort of mindset-based stuff. Week three might be something more practical, but have a think about what it is you do that makes up your process. Or the other way to think of this as well is, I'll use this example because a lot of people tend to, it's quite an easy one to understand. But there was a guy I mentioned earlier, John Romanello. He put out a product probably 6 years ago that did really, really, really well that was called Final Phase Fat Loss. And what that was anyone can put out an ebook on weight loss, fitness, whatever. He made it specifically for the people who wanted to lose that, get from like 12% down to 8% body fat or 10% down to 6%. It was very, very, very targeted. And all he did to find, to talk about his unique way of doing things was that one part of the program was doing essentially circuit training. So sort of lifting weights for time in a circuit fashion. Yet he positioned that as metabolic conditioning, which a lot of people do anyway, but by saying this is like the secret key to it, this is the secret sauce. All of a sudden, it differentiates that from everything else that's out there in the market. So even if it's just a case of giving your system a fancy name, the one that someone told me yesterday about, it's Frank Kern, I believe, has recently released something that he's calling, I think it's intention-based branding. And literally all it is write something on Facebook and link back to a landing page. That's it. So people are doing it already, but Frank's gone, well, I do this a lot. This works for me. Let's give this system a name. And he's called it intention-based branding, which is quite clever because all of a sudden it makes it feel quite new and quite different.
Yeah, and it makes it his, doesn't it? If he's
Yeah.
in a way, even though everybody else is already doing it,
If you can own something, even if other people are doing it, you know, if you called it like the Hodgson method, or if I called it the Samuel system, something like that, it just makes it feel a bit different.
Yeah, the Hodgson habit. Nobody's going to want that. It actually reminds me of, have you seen Mad Men? Have you watched Mad Men, Mike? You know, the Don Draper?
I figured that I really should watch it, so I've started watching it. I've not got very far yet.
There's obviously a lot of relationship stuff, which is interesting, but they do come up with some good ad stuff now and again. And there's a bit where they're trying to get the Lucky Strike deal, you know, the Lucky Strike manufacturers on board, and Don comes up with the tagline, "It's toasted," you know, Lucky Strike, it's toasted, and the guy from Lucky Strike says, "But everybody's as toasted," and Don says, "But yeah, but we're going to be the ones who say it," you know, and I'm not even sure how true it is. I'm sure there must be something that pulls some truth out of it as well. But it's just an example of it, isn't it? You know, or triple brewed, even, you know, people, things that, you know, drinks that are, these lagers that are triple brewed and stuff and things like that. And often, actually, a lot of them are, but it's putting it on there and giving it a stamp. But why do we buy into systems then? What's it? Do you know much about the psychology behind that then? Why do people tend to believe like a system? If you've got one,
the way that I explain it is because no one markets in a vacuum. Someone who comes to your Facebook page, your website, your landing page, whatever it is that you're getting your message out on, it's not going to be the case that you're the first dog trainer that they've ever set eyes on. They'll have seen stuff from other people, and chances are they'll have probably tried other stuff. And so in their head, they're already skeptical about, is this going to work? Because I've tried this other stuff and it's not. So there's so many objections there, thinking, is this person legitimate? Are they just going to sell me the same promises? I'm going to spend my money and nothing's going to happen. If you can show them you've got a different solution, then all of a sudden that builds confidence. And there's other stuff you need to do on top of that. You can't just have a system. You need to obviously do like the trust building. You need to talk about the benefits. You need to show that you understand their pain points. But having the system is the thing that, if they've been burned before, they're going to feel much more confidence in you because you're doing something different. It's like they're not just, say, for example, if someone's doing Facebook ads, if you've tried Facebook ads yourself before, or you've gone to someone to do them for you and they've not worked, if you see someone saying, "I'll do your Facebook ads for you," even if they're the best people in the world, you're going to think, well, Facebook ads don't work. If they say, "I've got my 6-step advertising solution system," all of a sudden it's like you're still going to be skeptical about stuff, and that can be tackled within the copy, but you're repositioning what's offered. So they've got no preconceived notions of whether that will work or not.
No, I like it. I like it. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So where do we start when we're creating something, you know, when we're creating some kind of marketing communication, be it like your website or a leaflet or something like that? Is there like a process that we should go through for everything that we do, or are things a little bit different depending on what you're using?
So it depends on the medium that you're going for, and obviously how much space you've got available, whether you're selling something or whether you're just making people aware of something or giving them something for free. But I'd always write down, there's a couple of bits I'd write down. I'd always write down a big idea, and a big idea is, what do I actually want to get from this? How do I want this to seem different? And that's pretty much what we've just talked about. But the other thing I do, and this is something very, very, very few people do.
Mike, can I just, sorry to be a nuisance, there's somebody at the door. I just need to take a parcel in. Give me one minute.
This conference will now be recorded.
Right, pal, sorry, you were saying the big idea.
Yeah, so the big idea is kind of a lot of what we just talked about in terms of what do you want to get across and how do you want to show people that you're different. But for me, the other thing, and a lot of people don't do this at all, and this is why it's, how should I put this, the The big thing when someone comes onto anything that you're doing, whether it is that Facebook page, landing page, Facebook profile, anything, is that you don't necessarily need to convince them to buy because they're there for a reason. It's not like all of a sudden it was thrust into their face or put on their computer screen without them knowing. They've come and looked for a solution to their problem. So they've come and looked for something they need for their pet. What we need to do is, instead of trying to sell them into it, we need to overcome their objections, because everyone has objections to buying. Obviously, the typical one is going to be price. There's going to be things like, is this person legitimate? Can I actually do this? There's so many things that people worry about that the main objection, that's probably the wrong word to use, but the main objective with a piece of copy is to overcome people's objections. And so if you're doing a long form sales page, let's say, that's probably going to be in excess of 4,000 words, you're probably going to want to have a list of about 40 objections that you want to bust in that. Obviously, that kind of stuff you don't write very regularly. So if you're just doing something like a Facebook post, I would always have that list of objections. Write down everything you think is a reason why people wouldn't invest in you. And a lot of them you'll have heard before. You know, you'll speak to a potential client and they'll say, I'd love to, but ... Whenever you hear that, write it down. Think up some of your own. And then when you do a piece of content or a piece of marketing, make sure you're tackling at least one objection, whether it's the price one, whether it's the, you know, well, we've tried all this other stuff before and it doesn't work. Doesn't matter what it is, but in your marketing, you need to try and strategically bust those whenever you put something out. And I'd also think about what we said before about your values, trying to get an element of that into what you're writing. And I realize that's kind of vague advice, but that would probably be the best thing I can suggest for any piece of marketing if we're keeping it broad.
Cool. So the two things were having some analysis of objections and dealing with an objection in the copy, yep, and putting your values across as well. Yeah. I guess essentially what you're saying there is that this is why I'm different. This is why I'm different to the people you've tried before. And this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. You know, or, you know, this is why I do it this way, you know, because these are my values. Yeah.
Yeah, essentially. And the thing is, if you can make people feel that you're different, that's a big thing anyway. Even if you don't talk about a load of benefits, then for me, a piece of copy, there always needs to be the idea that most people probably won't buy now anyway. That's just, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're the best copywriter in the world. But if you can make them read something that actually they read from start to finish and that they remember, then even if they go away and try other stuff that doesn't work, they're going to come back to you. And that's the big thing. That's why people tend to freak out if they don't get an amazing conversion rate on something. But it's not all about what happens in the here and now. It's about making sure you're also building those relationships with people.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, it's like a, yeah, yeah. You've got to think a bit long game, haven't you, with this?
Yes, definitely.
Cool. So in your experience then, is there any, or do you have any kind of fallback objections that you always, or that you often go to, you know?
So price is always going to be one. Doesn't matter what it is, even if you're selling something at £10, there's probably going to be a price objection, and you can get around that by doing some reframing. So the typical one that is a bit cliche but it works is like, compare it to cups of coffee. So if you can make people think, if you're selling something for £100, you can reframe that as, actually, how many people do you know who spend £3 a day on a cup of coffee? It's basically the same thing. You can get around that as well by talking about how much is this worth to you. You know, theoretically, something like this could be priceless. I mean, if someone's got a dog who's just, you know, they want it to be part of their family and they love it, but at the moment it's ruining their lives, what would they actually pay to fix that? It's going to be a lot of money, because the stress that's being caused at the moment is so huge. So you need to just make sure you're getting that kind of stuff across. So yeah, price is always going to be there. And probably the idea that I've tried other stuff and it's not worked for me. or there are other options out there. Why is this one the one to go for? And you can tackle those head on, particularly if you've got a longer piece of copy. If you're writing a sales page, I will always put an FAQ at the bottom, and I'll have probably the top 8 to 10 questions, even if I've kind of addressed them in the rest of the copy. I'll have an FAQ just saying, you know, how is this different from other stuff out there? You can also think practically in terms of if you're doing some sort of class every week and it's always at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday night, and you know that timing is an objection for people, you could reframe that saying, well, look, it might be a struggle to get it from work, but actually we've had people before who they've still, you know, we don't demand that you get here bang on the hour. You'll still get all the benefit if you rock up 10 minutes late. And actually, you know, we've had people before who've even missed weeks and still got amazing results. So anything you feel that in your prospect's head is going to be something that stops them from investing, make a note of that, have it as your master list, let's say, and then in shorter pieces of copy, you try and get in one or two of those, and longer pieces, you try and get the majority.
Yeah, nice one. And it's worth doing some digging, isn't it? You know, like with your current clients, past clients as well, find out what those objections were or that they did have when they were thinking about it, because you'll come up with some gold sometimes. You know, like I know a big one for what I do with the walking and the training, and probably even for the groomers as well who do that is safety. You know, the owners are terrified of you losing their dog, you know, or their dog getting bitten or something like that. And this is like something that keeps them awake at night, you know, worrying about their dog. So if you're not working that in there somehow, you're not dealing with the main objection, are you?
No, and the best people to get research from for whatever you're doing are probably past and current clients. And actually, you can massively transform a testimonial. What a lot of people do in their testimonials is they'll put, you know, here's so-and-so. In this case, when so-and-so came to me, you know, when Susan came to me, her dog was keeping her up all night, and within 6 weeks we fixed that and everything was fine. If you add into that, Susan had gone through, you know, had tried several other local trainers and got no results, or Susan had already spent £3,000 trying to fix this and got no result. What that does is it shows anyone reading it now, it's okay to have those potential objections, because this person had it, this person overcame those, invested and got the result. So it's very powerful to put in, to acknowledge that people you've helped have had objections in the past.
Yes, yes, it is. Yeah, well, it's way more powerful than you talking about how good you are. Brilliant. So are there some kind of common mistakes people fall into, Mike, with their copy?
Probably selling too hard. I think if you're selling in everything, then it doesn't come across very well. I'm not necessarily against, you know, there are a lot of people who do like a daily email and who sell in that every single time, and it can work. But for me, it has to be more of a focus on the long game for this.
Yeah.
And probably the big mistake is trying to make stuff too formal. So whenever you're writing something that you actually want people to read, we're not writing a novel. It. That's where people get tend to get caught up, as they think everything has to be word perfect, it has to be very formal, it has to be in chunks of text. You can pretty much write how you speak, maybe not perfectly, maybe not replicating it exactly, because if you did that, you'd end up with lots of ums and ahs, and you know, I know for example that I say really and basically a lot, so I wouldn't put that into copy. But it's the idea that I think I heard this from Tim Ferriss, and he was actually talking about blogging, but it applies to copy as well. When you're writing something, it should be as much as possible how you would speak to a friend at the bar if you'd had a couple of drinks, i.e. you're slightly looser than normal, but you're still making sense. You're being very conversational. You want to make it as much like a conversation as possible. So that's why I don't like the typical sales letters of, you know, dear friend, blah blah blah, you know. This letter is an example of the most, you know, the most incredible system for X you've ever heard before. It needs to be in my mind, particularly for British audiences as well. I think Americans, you can kind of get away with a bit more hypey stuff. But yeah, for British audiences, just think of it as having a chat with people and just honestly telling them why your product or your service is good. That's the big thing, is that people think, well, I need to make up why my product or service is good. Actually, if you believe in what you're selling, you shouldn't have to do that. It's just putting why it's good onto paper.
Yeah, no, for sure. Brilliant advice. Brilliant advice, Mike. So, a couple of things just to finish off then. You mentioned about emails there, Mike, and I do dailies. I have done for a few years. I've noticed you've kind of, well, I don't know if you ever did dailies, but you certainly did them often, didn't you? And I've noticed that you've gone for a more kind of, what you're on now, twice a week, a bit more. I like
Yeah,
them, don't get me wrong.
possibly.
I love the style and stuff, yeah, but I do sell in every email as I like to use this opportunity just to do a bit of personal brain picking for my own benefit as well, because I'm a selfish bastard. But I do. I mean, mine are very chatty, hopefully entertaining still. Do you know what I mean? But I do sell every day, and for me, it's a habit I don't really want to get out of either. You know, because I don't know. I kind of sets me up for the day writing the email. You know. So what's your kind of strategy on that? And I want to ask you a little bit about kind of Facebook and stuff as well, and where you see Facebook going, challenges using
Cool.
engagement and stuff on there.
So for email, I think, as I said, some people do the daily thing well and they can sell, because particularly if you are making it humorous, you're making it chatty. The bottom line is, obviously, if it's going well, like if the classic phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So that's always my advice to people. My reasoning for going to, there's a few reasons why I went from pretty much every day, it was like 5 days a week, down to just twice. Basically timing. I didn't particularly want to be doing a daily email. I didn't want to spend that much time doing it. I also found that, by and large, I think the vast majority of people write better quality emails when they do fewer of them. It's like anything, you get a lot better with practice, and consistent practice, and doing lots of practice early on. For me, I think it's easier to get writing burnout and to still write well, but perhaps not write absolute home run emails the more often you do them. The other thing that I found was, and I'm not going to claim to have come up with this idea myself, it was told to me by someone else, but his theory was, he would always rather be the kind of person who, if his subscribers didn't get an email from him, they were really, really disappointed, than be the kind of person who emailed all the time and people just either got bored or didn't open, or worse still, thought, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm going to unsubscribe. So that was the key for me when he put it like that. And
And
I
who
just
taught
did.
you that?
It's a guy called John Street, who
Right.
is, he's an excellent marketer. He lives near me. He's pretty under the radar, specialized in email marketing. Yeah, and that was his theory. So when he said that to me, I've kind of not really been enjoying doing daily email for the last probably 3 or 4 months. And yeah, so I changed twice a week, and for me, the results have been better for that.
Brilliant, brilliant. Cool. No, it's excellent. Yeah, no, and I excellent emails, Mike. I love your stuff. I love all the
Definitely.
stuff that you're putting out. It's great. So where do, like, you, I mean, we said almost not quite at the start, but certainly early on, about how things have changed over the year. You talked about SEO changing massively, and like when I first started the dog business, Facebook was a brilliant place to, you know, grow your business locally. And you know, if you're putting on better pictures than everybody else, you'd be laughing, you know. Now it's very much different story, isn't it? So where does Facebook fit into your kind of funnel, if you like, and where do you see it going?
I still get some business from Facebook, but I certainly think that any form of social media is not nearly as effective for direct selling as email is. So I've consistently, obviously you can't track every single lead and every sale, and there's a lot of crossover between email and Facebook, but I get a lot more from my email list, which is about 20% the size of my friends, so to speak, on social media. So social media,
Me
I
too.
find
Me
is,
too. I sell way more. But anyway, carry
yeah,
on. Sorry.
no worries. It's yeah, for me, it's one of those where, obviously, from a technical standpoint, Facebook don't particularly like people directing others off the platform, and they don't particularly want you using a personal page as a business. So I almost see Facebook more as being useful for kind of personal branding stuff and developing those relationships with people, because it's a bit more of an open conversation, I suppose. And so I like both. Facebook for me tends to be more of the stuff where it's either the more humorous things that don't really add much value to people but maybe give them a laugh, or it's the more lifestyle based stuff. So some visuals perhaps, talking a bit more about yeah, lifestyle. So, what you're up to.
Yeah.
Email is where I
Which is
try and,
personality, I guess, isn't it? It's like personality marketing, isn't it? Yeah.
yeah, definitely. And that can still come across an email. It's not a case that I write any differently for them, but certainly email is more sit down, block out half an hour, try and really deliver something of as big a value as I possibly can through email.
Yeah. Cool, man. Brilliant. Hey, Mike, this has been fantastic. I feel like it's flown over as well. Christ, I feel like we're just scratching the surface here. Maybe I'll get you on another couple of months, eh? We'll go a bit deeper, maybe into,
That'd be
or
good,
just
mate. Yeah.
talk about some other stuff. Because, yeah, I've really, really enjoyed it, and I know my guys will get a lot of value as well. Where can people go to find out a bit more about you or whatever?
So again, super unprofessional. The best place is honestly just Facebook. Just add me on Facebook. If people have any questions, or if they want to get on the list, then I've got a free guide that helps people with their email autoresponders. So if they want that, add me on Facebook, pop me a message. But yeah, that's probably the best place. I don't keep things too formal at all.
Brilliant, brilliant. Excellent, Mike. Well, thank you very much, my friend. That's been absolutely stellar.
No, it's been
And
fun.
yeah, I'll hopefully I'll see you or speak to you sometime with well, soon in the next year. Be fab.
Good, mate. Definitely.
Thanks again, mate. Take care.
Cheers, Dom.